questions, and all kinds of exciting things like that.
I co-coordinated, though. I couldn't do that on my own. It's not on me at all.
And it's not even a paid position. Let's Talk Science. It's an affiliation of grad students all across Canada who run chapters out of universities all across Canada. They, both of them, really enjoy telling people, decomplicating science for the general public. And it was Aaron who approached me back in January and said, I'd really, really like to do a Freaky Friday. Is there a chance of doing one on the rise of infectious diseases? And that's where this all started. They will give a 45-minute talk. They're co-presenting together. It's going to be very dynamic. They're using clickers, so you have to participate. You can't just sit back passively. And then after they finish, we'll have questions. If you have to leave during the questions, please exit through the door up there, because we're filming this and archiving it. It'll be preserved as a webcast. It might even show up on Canal Savoir. After we finish and close down and they leave, we'll have a little bit of a gap, about maybe a 15-minute gap. You can go and get yourself a pizza or something at Timmy's. Come back if you want to see the film. Contagion is an excellent feature-length film exactly about really rapid spreading infectious disease. It's totally fictional, but it's very dramatic. I have to plug our next public speaker is Tracy Webb. Next Thursday night, Tracy is a physicist. She studies stardust. She'll be here in this room, 6 o'clock Thursday, March 14th, and the talk title is Witnessing the Formation and the Evolution of Galaxies. And that's on her monitor behind her is apparently a photo she took of the antennae galaxies. They're actually colliding. And the tiny blue pieces you see there are the actual stars bursting in flame. And the other thing I want to plug is a series of 5 lectures that begin also next Thursday. Mini Science for this year, the theme is Science, Sex, and Gender. Really good price for 5 of them. You're going to learn everything about gender, from the chemistry of gender to sexual aggression to genetic conflict in ants. So if that kind of thing interests you, the price is right. I'll pass these around and you can mail them in. You can also register online. So that's all I have to say. A long introduction. Welcome. Have fun.
Thanks.
Okay. So, hi everyone. Thank you, Ingrid, for letting us come and talk to you guys tonight. So, we are going to talk about bugs, drugs, and the amazing race. So, why did we choose this subject? If you read newspapers, you could easily get scared by headlines such as mutant E. coli and killer food bugs. Especially then, if you think when you go to hospital, you're going to go and get another superbug like MRSA and die. So, it's all a bit doom and gloom, really. So what we're aiming to do tonight is to really cut through this kind of sensationalist stuff and tell a story about A, the bugs themselves, B, the drugs for the bugs, and then kind of describe this marathon race for survival between humans and microbes that has been going on for millennia.
And so, but first, before we start talking, we want to have some interactive time with you guys. So, you notice we handed out these funny things. They're called clickers. If you don't have some, we can pass them out. And what they're going to do is it's basically a response system. And so we'll put up a question, and the answers will be numbered 1 through 5 or 1 through 6. And whatever you think is the correct answer, you press that button, and it will record your response in the computer. And then we'll get to see the answer right away. And you'll know it recorded because the little green light on the clicker lit up. Does that make sense? All right, awesome.
There is no prize, though.
That's yes, there's no prize. And we need these back at the end. You can't take them home.
Okay, so first up, has there ever been a time in human history when we have been free of infectious diseases?
So you can just press the button now?
Tough questions. We're not going to give you an easy ride. So there's 26.
All right, so that's probably about accurate. Yep. Any more coming in? So there you go.
Okay, so most of you are right. The correct answer is no. We have always had to live with some sort of infectious disease or another.
Next question. What percentage of annual global deaths are believed to be caused by infectious diseases? 8.5%, 15.5%, 25.5%, or 50%?
I've got some quick responders.
Okay. And so the correct answer is that 25.5% of, or a quarter of annual global deaths each year are believed to be caused by infectious diseases.
Okay, next up. In the human body, for every 100 human cells, how many bacterial cells will there be, or microbial cells? 50, 100, 1,000, or 10,000? Okay. So, let's see. Okay, you're quite ambitious. The ratio is actually 10 to 1, but it's quite surprising that there are 10 times more microbial cells in you than your own cells.
So the answer is 3. There's 1,000 for every 100, or 10 to 1. Next question. In the average public restroom, what percentage of people wash their hands after using the toilet? 45%, 65%, 85%, or 95%? This is actually a study done by, I think, the American Cleaning Institute with the American Society of Microbiology. It was at public parks and things like that, yeah. So the correct answer is actually 85%, so better than most people thought, but still kind of gross if you think that 15% of people don't wash their hands when they leave the washroom.
Okay, next up, out of the following options, what is the best way to avoid getting sick? Not touching common surfaces, so like door handles or bus rails, healthy eating, exercise and sleeping well, washing your hands or avoiding hospitals? Which one's the best? So as you say, they're all pretty good, but the correct answer is 4. Washing your hands is the easiest way of getting rid of any microbes that you may have on your skin.
So next, this is a personal question for you to answer. Did you get the seasonal flu shot this year? These are anonymous. These are not linked, so you can answer honestly. Okay.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, about 50-50. Cool.
Okay, so out of curiosity, if you did answer no, so only the people who answered no in the previous question, what was your reason? Was it because you never get sick, so there's no point? You didn't know where to get it? Too much of an inconvenience? Scared of needles? Or you don't believe the vaccines work? Or some other sort of reason? Okay, so that should probably be... Only half of it.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Oh, so quite a spectrum. So actually, most people seem to believe in 1 in 5. So those who answer 1 or 5, listen in later, and Erin will explain how important and effective vaccines are.
All right, the next question is a bit of a long one, so we'll give you a bit more time. What are 3 key components that define a pandemic? Is it caused by a specific disease with global distribution and an increased number of people affected? Is it a novel infectious disease with high mortality and no known cure? Is it a specific disease that has global distribution and high mortality, a specific infectious disease with an increased number of people affected and no known cure? Or finally, is it a specific disease, an increased number of people affected, and comes from pandas? All right. So the correct answer is actually 1. So epidemic is caused, well done, is by a specific disease, so it doesn't have to be infectious and doesn't have to be brand new. It has to have global distribution and an increased number of people affected compared to what's normally known.
Okay, a quick one this time. True or false? There is a risk that I can get flu from my flu shot. Okay. All quite quick. Okay, so again, roughly half and half. False. The vaccine is actually a killed virus, and there is no way it can come back to life inside you. So you cannot get the flu from a flu shot.
Now switching a bit to bacteria, which bacterial species on this list can be harmless to humans? E. coli, Streptococcus aureus, Staphylococcus epidermis, Lactobacillus fermentum, or all of the above?
Okay.
That's correct for number five, all of the above. And this was a bit of a trick question because these bacteria, they all can be harmless, but they can also be harmful. So, for example, E. coli or some strains of strep or staph, if they get into the wrong part of your body, can cause a very serious problem.
Okay, another true or false. So I've been prescribed antibiotics. I should finish the full course of this antibiotics even if I start to feel better about halfway through. Okay. Okay, so you are all pretty much all correct. So basically you have to totally eradicate the bacteria by using the full course of the antibiotics and not leave those few resistant stragglers.
And then our last question, true or false, antibiotics can treat a virus? The correct answer is indeed false. Antibiotics are only for bacteria. They can't treat a virus. So just as a note before we get into the rest of our talk, we do need these clickers back. We borrowed them from McGill. You can't take them home. So if you do end up leaving early, you can just leave them sort of in front of you, or if you leave at the end, you're welcome to just bring them down and return them to us.
Okay, so we've had fun time. Now we're into some learning. So microbiology 101. So microbiology is basically the study of microscopic organisms. And there are many, many categories of microscopic organisms. So you can get microscopic animals, like dust mites, or you can get parasites that cause malaria. But I'm going to focus on the three main categories today of that affect our daily life. So first up, bacteria. So the guys that we really hear about all the time are like Staphylococcus aureus, so, as in MRSA, and E. coli, which is we normally associate with food poisoning, but we can also have in our gut. So bacteria as a general group are very versatile. They can live anywhere, ranging from hot springs through to kind of ice flows. They can cause disease or they can be beneficial, like probiotics. And they're typically 0.5 to 5 microns long. So that's about 1/100 if you take a piece of paper, it's about 1/100 the thickness of the paper. So very, very small. So then we have fungus or yeasts, which generally some people might think are very similar to bacteria, but actually they're genetically closer to humans than they are to the bacteria. So the yeasts we know are Candida, the cause of yeast infections, but then you also get good guys like Saccharomyces, which we use in baking and also probably more importantly brewing. So these guys are a little bit larger and, as I say, they're more closely related to us humans than they are to bacteria. So the third main category of microorganism is the virus. So main guys we've heard of, HIV, herpes and SARS. So these are even smaller. So these are about 1/10 to 1/100 the size of a bacteria. And the most important thing about these guys is they're not living like the bacteria and the yeasts. They are basically a box of protein that contains genetic material. So they have to live in a host, like a human or an animal, to actually have any effect. And when they do, they get replicating. They can replicate 10 billion new viruses a day, which, considering our population is 7 billion, is pretty impressive. So, having had our microbiology 101, you'll see that this advert for a shoe cleanser, which has the line, "Even the fungus responsible for the highly contagious MRSA bacteria is about as false as you can get." But you can still buy one for $140 if you want, but I probably wouldn't. So, having talked about, for the rest of the course, for the rest of my part, I'm going to talk about bacteria and not talk about the viruses and the fungus. So, what is a bacteria really? So, I welcome you to Bacteriopolis. My city. So first up, we're going to build a cell wall. So as a normal cell wall, it gives you a cell structure, and it gives you defined limits and size. And it also gives you protection, so you can filter what comes in and out of your city. Some bacteria will go for a slightly thinner cell wall, but an outer moat. But technically, they basically do the same thing. Next up, we need government, so that everything in the city works functionally. So this is the job of the DNA. The DNA is basically a library of instruction manuals. So it can't do anything by itself, but it knows how to do everything. We then have ribosomes, which are like the factories of the city. So the ribosomes basically read the DNA, the instruction manuals, unlike most men, and they then make the required products. So they can make structural components, like for the cell wall, or they can make the machines that make everything work. So in a nutshell, that is a bacteria, the three main components. But they all work in a very clever way. So let's pretend that bacteria is working in a kind of, finds itself in a very starved environment. So there are sensors in and around the cell that can detect that there's limited nutrients. So they'll send a message through a very efficient bureaucratic chain to the DNA. The right instruction manuals will then be sent over to the ribosomes, where the corresponding products will be assembled. So we could imagine what would be assembled as some scavengers to make sure that you'll get every last drop of nutrient available. And you'll get people to go around telling the rest of the cell to kind of calm down and not waste any unnecessary energy. So this is basically how bacteria get to adapt to so many different environments. So one of the environments they like to inhabit is us. So how have we combated combated bacteria in the past? So at the end of the 19th century, Antoine Beauchamp in Paris, who is a chemist turned biologist, who was a great rival of Louis Pasteur of pasteurization fame. So he used to synthesize dyes for the dyeing manufacturing industry, but also developed random chemicals. And one of these chemicals, etoxol, was proved to be effective at treating sleeping sickness. So that was great. As this kind of side effect, but one of the toxic side effects was that it caused blindness in 2% of patients, which is obviously undesirable. So then Paul Ehrlich from Germany, who is considered to be the founder of modern immunology, so in his time he used to look at dyes again, but for the purpose of differentially staining human cells, so he could differentiate all the different human cells. But during his research, he also stumbled across the fact that bacteria die differently to human cells. So what he thought was this magic bullet concept. He said if a dye can bind preferentially to a bacterial cell but not a human cell, and then we adapted that to actually kill the bacteria at the same time, then we can find a non-toxic drug that can cure humans. So what he did with his very, very patient assistant was to screen variations of this original drug, so basically modifying one bit here and there to look for antibacterial non-toxic properties. So after 5 long years, and at the 606th attempt, he finally came across a compound called salvarin, which was then used very widely for the treatment of syphilis for the next 10, 20 years. So you've got to be patient in this game. So, and the next kind of major step in antibacterial research was done by Gerhard Dormack, also in Germany. So he went for this sort of approach of randomly screening chemicals. So he screened thousands and thousands of dyes for antibacterial properties, and then discovered in 1935 Prontosil, which was found to be very good at treating staphylococcal infections and children diseases. And it took off very quickly and was very popular, and in fact, its claim to fame was it was used to cure Franklin D. Roosevelt's son. So he probably felt quite good about that. So some of us, maybe the English contingent, would be thinking, where is Alexander Fleming in this? Because penicillins, surely that's the first antibiotic. Technically, it is the first antibiotic. So Alexander Fleming was a Scotsman studying at Oxford, and I think as a good scientist, he was slightly chaotic and disorganised, and he was working on bacterial structures. And so he would have plates of Staphylococcus lying around in his lab, and he may not have put them away like he should have done. And he came back from his summer holiday and noticed that one of his plates had become contaminated. So you can see here that the white circle at the bottom is the fungus penicillin, and then the rest of that smear is the Staphylococcus. And so you can see that there's no bacteria very close to the penicillin, the fungus. So indicating that the fungus is killing the bacteria through a kind of secreted molecule of some sort. So he then spent 12 years growing that very same fungus and trying to purify the active agent that was killing the bacteria. But he wasn't a chemist, so eventually he gave this fungus to two chemists, also at Oxford, Florey and Chain, who obviously saw the benefit of this potent antibacterial compound, and recruited half of their department into working out how to get how to purify and manufacture this magic compound. So in 1945, they finally achieved it, and they named the drug penicillin after the fungus Penicillium. And penicillin, as we probably all heard of, has now saved millions and millions of lives worldwide. And that is why they won the Nobel Prize later on. So what we see here is an antibiotic is a substance that is produced by one microorganism that kills another microorganism, as opposed to a synthetic dye that we've seen previously. So this basically kick-started the golden age of antibiotics. So you can see here, at 1941, at the discovery of penicillin, well, that's actually inaccurate. Over the next 20 years, all these different categories of drugs were discovered. So this is 13 different categories, and each category has many drugs within that category. And they all come from various bacteria and fungus. So we've got Streptomyces here producing aminoglycosides. We've got a fungus that produces the cephalosporins, and then another bacteria that produces macrolides. So different categories of antibiotics produced by different bacteria and funguses. So what this guy, Selman Waksman, had done, having seen Fleming's work on how one microorganism can kill another, basically went around the country getting soil samples from hundreds of different places, and basically purified any bacteria he could from them and pitted them against each other in a mass war to see which one survived. Thus, the ones that survived were obviously the ones producing the most antibiotics. So, as you can see, this was quite a rough science. It was finding out what killed what. They didn't really know how these antibiotics were killing. So if we go back to Bacteriopolis, and you think about how we would destroy it, you can target the cell wall. So that's how Alexander Fleming's penicillins worked. You can also target the DNA so that it doesn't know how to function. Or you can target the factories, the ribosomes. So this is the macrolides that Waksman found. So it got to a stage where we had all these antibiotics that people started really thinking that we had won this war. And Professor Pietersdorf, who was a leading expert, said, "Even with my great personal loyalty to infectious disease, I cannot conceive of the need for 309 more graduating trainees in infectious disease unless they spend their time culturing each other." And this was a kind of general feeling that antibiotics were going to cure humans of all infectious disease. But the bugs are not going to lie down. They're going to fight back. So, going back to Bacteriopolis, how do the microbes fight back? So we've said that the antibiotics can target the cell wall. So the microbes just change the cell wall. So the drugs are ineffective again. Or you change the cell wall machinery so that, again, the drugs aren't recognized. This can also work with both the DNA and the ribosomes. You just change the structure so that it doesn't affect the function of them, but it affects the recognition by our drugs. Slightly more crass, you basically kick the drugs out. So you have efflux pumps, which take your drug that's in the bacteria and you just kick it out of the cell, so before it has a chance to work. Or you destroy the drug before it has a chance to enter the cell. And bacteria are very clever, so they code all these slightly altered bacterial components on small portable DNA so that it can share it with its neighbouring bacteria. So this is how resistance can spread. So looking at a case study now, to really put this in context, we'll look at the case of penicillin resistance. So this drug here is penicillin, the very one that Alexander Fleming and his colleagues found. So it's very scary looking. But basically, if you look at this structure highlighted, that component there is called beta-lactam. And that basically mimics the cell wall, the bricks, per se, of the cell wall. And so what it does is it binds to the... Let's call a cell wall a normal wall. You have a brick layer, and he has his bricks, and he puts them together to build the cell wall. However, penicillin looks like the original bricks, but is covered in glue. So when the builder picks it up, it can't lay any more bricks. But penicillin has a very narrow spectrum. So it can only target the ones with the thick cell wall. It can't target those ones that have the moat, can't cross the moat. So chemists then added this NH2 group, as you can see here, and this allows it to be transported across the moat and enter the cells of the gram-negative bacteria. So one step at a time. Both these drugs are great, and they're very effective at targeting their relevant bacteria, but they were destroyed by the acid in the human stomach. So they got modified one more time to amoxicillin. So you add this group on at the end, and it is resistant to the acid. Therefore, amoxicillin can be taken as a pill, whereas the other two, ampicillin and penicillin, had to be injected. So basically, you can see here, this has been we've taken a natural drug, and we've just changed it bit by bit to make it more suitable for human use and more effective. But then bacteria fight back, and they produce a thing called a beta-lactamase, which targets all of these drugs in that kind of red-ringed part of the molecule and breaks it and rendering it ineffective. So we saw this rise in resistance. So we developed Augmentin, which is the same drug as before, amoxicillin, but we then used clavulanic acid. So you can see clavulanic acid has a very similar shape as the penicillin drugs, but doesn't target the brick layer himself, but targets the inhibitor, the beta-lactamase, thus allowing the amoxicillin itself to go off and work against the bacteria. We then discovered methicillin, which itself was naturally resistant to the action of these beta-lactamases, so we could just use that by itself. However, so we can now treat bacteria that produce these kind of scissors, but the bacteria then responded by changing the brick layer for someone who had glasses and can spot the proper drug from the host, the drug from the cell wall components. So we then have methicillin is the cause of MRSA, and this is the very widespread disease, which is can cause serious infections. So we've had to now go to a completely different class of drug called vancomycin, and this is a very last resort sort of drug. So as you can see, it doesn't have any of the same structures, so it works in an entirely different route. Unfortunately, it is toxic, so that's why it's a last resort drug. And we can show that resistance is slowly emerging to this now. So this is, as you, what I hope I portrayed is this ongoing battle of how the bacteria develop one sort of resistance mechanism, and then we counter it, and then they come back with a completely different mechanism of resistance. And then just finally, for the spread of resistance, we can see here, so this is global rates of MRSA. And so you can see that in America, over 50% of the Staphylococcus isolates are resistant to methicillin, whereas in Finland and Scandinavia, the Scandinavian countries, resistance is lower than 5%, which is very good. And this is basically because in America, you can get an antibiotic for anything. You just go in and say you've got a cold, and they'll give you an antibiotic. But in Scandinavia, they're very strict on the use of antibiotics, and also very they crack down as soon as any antibiotic resistance is detected. So that's basically where we stand now with antibiotics, is there are fewer antibiotics coming out of the pipeline than in that golden era, but we're now aware of the mechanisms of resistance, and so there's more reporting and intelligent use of antibiotics. And so this will be an ongoing war, but we're in good stand. So.
Cool, so I'm going to take over. And as Richard discussed, antibiotics are just one of the ways that we fight bugs, or in particular we fight bacteria. But another way that we have a drug to fight these bugs is we have vaccines. And what a vaccine is it is a substance that when it's injected into you, it stimulates your immune response, and it stimulates it to produce antibodies. And these antibodies can then protect you against a future infection with whatever was put in the vaccine, whatever strain was in there. Now, a very famous man in the vaccination world is a man named Edward Jenner. And he's not necessarily the first person to use the concept of vaccination, but he's one of the more famous ones. And during Edward Jenner's time, smallpox was a very serious disease. And what was known about smallpox were two things. One was that if a person got smallpox and survived the infection, they were protected from getting another smallpox infection, so they were immune. And the second thing was that dairy maids, so people who worked with cows, could get cowpox, which is similar to smallpox, but if they got that, they were actually protected from smallpox. So knowing that, what he did in May of 1796 was he took samples from fresh cowpox lesions and he gave them to a kid, James Phipps, who was 8 years old. So he took cowpox and infected James with this. And then a couple months later, he gave James smallpox. And what he found was that James didn't get sick. He didn't get smallpox. So this suggested that by giving him cowpox, he protected him from the smallpox. Now, a really important concept in order for vaccines to work at a population level is the concept of herd immunity. And I promise you that this has nothing to do with cow herds. But what it does have to do with is the idea that a certain percentage of the population must be vaccinated in order for the whole population to be protected. So if I put this another way, if I were to get vaccinated, I can't get infected with, so let's say I get the influenza vaccine, I can't get infected with those strains of influenza, which means I can't pass it on to someone else, and I've broken the cycle of infection. So these next graphics are a really good way to demonstrate it. So what you can see here on the left is the blue people are healthy, but they didn't get the vaccine. And then the two red people didn't get a vaccine and they're sick. So you can see that they're able to spread the disease throughout the population really easily. If we look and see that we have a couple of yellow people in the population on the left, and these people are healthy, but they got the vaccine. And you can see that there's only a few of them, so the two people who are infected with the red virus can still spread it pretty well throughout the population. But then finally, if we have a population where the majority is immunized, even though there are sick people in the population, they really can't spread it to that many people because most people are protected. Now, before you start thinking, oh, well, thank goodness, there's herd immunity, I don't have to get immunized, in order for herd immunity to actually work, as you can see from this figure, anywhere from 70 to 95% of the population has to be vaccinated in order for this to be effective and to actually have population-level protection. So What I wanted to show you with this infographic is that vaccines have had a huge impact on global health. So this was created using data from the CDC report on the impact of vaccines in the 20th and 21st centuries. And if you look on the left-hand column, you can see that before vaccines came about, this is the estimated annual morbidity in the States. So that's morbidity is a measure of how many sick people there are. And on the right-hand side, you can see the most recent cases of all of these diseases in the States. And in the middle, you can see the decrease. So if you look at something like diphtheria or smallpox or polio, we can see that there's been a 100% decrease in the number of cases of these diseases just because of vaccination alone. Now, despite the fact that vaccines have done an amazing job improving global health, we still have these emerging infectious diseases. And by emerging, I mean both diseases that are newly emerging, so they've never infected humans before, but also diseases that are re-emerging in the population, such as MRSA, as Richard discussed. So some of these new diseases that you might have heard of include HIV, it includes Ebola and Marburg viruses, both of which cause hemorrhagic fevers, the SARS virus, E. coli 0157H7, which causes a really nasty gastrointestinal problem, and then, of course, influenza virus, with strains such as H5N1 causing the bird flu and H1N1 causing swine flu. So despite all of our knowledge about the human immune response and these pathogens and potential ways to treat them, why do infectious diseases continue to emerge and continue to spread? Well, most often, the emergence and spread of these new infectious diseases, or re-emerging diseases, is a direct result of changes in the microbe, or in the pathogen, the environment, as well as the host, or the human. And most importantly, how these changes affect the other components of this triangle. So I'd like to go through these in a bit more detail. So some microbial factors that are known to cause the increase of diseases is natural mutation. So an example of this is the seasonal influenza virus. So influenza, as it replicates or as it makes new viruses, there's natural errors that occur when it replicates. And the virus doesn't have any way of checking and fixing these errors. So it's able to mutate, and in a sense it changes at a very high rate, which means these new strains are always coming out. Another way the microbe can change is that it has necessary evolution. So as Richard discussed, we apply antibiotics to bacteria, and they have to evolve in order to survive. So we have forced them to evolve, in a sense. And then also there's antigenic shift. And the best way to describe antigenic shift is the example of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, which everyone remembers as swine flu. And so what was known in swine flu is that it was actually a mix of three different viruses that made this brand new virus. So it was a mix of a bird influenza, a pig influenza, and a human influenza. So what can happen, as you can see here, the human influenza and the bird influenza can all mix together in an intermediate host, such as the pig. And as you can see in the bottom there, as the virus enters the cell, it opens up, it loses its protein coat, and the genetic material goes into the cell. Once in the cell, as it's replicating, these genetic components can swap really easily, such that when a new virus is packaged up, you can have a component of the old virus that allows it to infect humans, plus a component of the bird virus that might make it a very severe disease in humans. So it's a brand new virus that's created. Now, the environment can also play a role in emerging diseases. And this includes both ways that we manipulate our environment as well as natural environmental factors. So one way we manipulate the environment is through our practices in farming. And for example, it was discovered that the disease bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or better known as mad cow disease, may have spread so easily through the populations of cows because we were used to feed cows with the ground up meat and bones of previously slaughtered cattle. Another thing I'm sure we've all heard instances of is contamination of the food or water supply. So often we'll hear of contamination of sandwich meat processing facilities, or a very famous case was in Walkerton, Ontario, where their water supply got contaminated with E. coli 0157H7. And then finally, another environmental factor linked to the emergence of new diseases is natural disasters. So what I'm showing in this figure is some of the tent cities that arose in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. And what happens in natural disasters is that there's a complete breakdown of public health systems and often of sanitation systems too. And then when you combine that with the fact that people end up living in crowded conditions, it allows diseases to spread really easily. And of course, we have our human actions or the host things that can cause infectious diseases to emerge. And the list I'm going to show you is both things we do as a society as well as our individual actions. So one thing we do as a society is we have urbanized. So it's estimated that around 50% of the current global population is living in cities. So what this means is that people are more crowded together, which allows diseases to spread much more easily, but also that with increased numbers of people in the city, there's increased sexual partners, as well as increased presence of sex trade workers, which can lead to HIV spreading. Another thing we love to do as a population is we love to travel internationally. And it was estimated in 2004, which by now is almost a decade ago, that approximately 1 million people travel internationally every day, and about 1 million every week travel between developed and developing countries, which is a really great way to take pathogens around. And to show a visual representation of that, this map illustrates global commercial airline travel. You can barely see the countries for all the airline networks. And this was put together by a group called BioDiaspora, and what they're doing is they're working to understand global travel to try and understand how diseases might spread and how we could stop the spread of those diseases. Another host factor is war, and war is very similar to natural disaster in that it can cause the breakdown of public health systems, which can lead to the spread of disease. Something that can be both personal and societal is the immune status. So your personal immune status can affect whether or not you get a disease, but the immune status of the society as a whole can also affect that. So for example, we have more people today than ever before living with AIDS, which is the chronic form of HIV infection. And what this means is these people have a compromised immune system. So we're seeing bacteria and fungus that normally wouldn't infect a healthy person is able to infect these people and cause a serious problem. And so we're seeing a lot more of this today. Bioterrorism is another way that infectious diseases can emerge. And so I'm sure most of you remember the anthrax spores that were put in the U.S. mail in 2001 that resulted in 5 deaths. But I would like to point out that biological terrorism is nothing new. And it's been suggested that during the Seven Years' War in the mid-18th century, the British gave smallpox-infected blankets to the Native Americans. And it's also been suggested that as far back as 1346, during the siege of Caffa, that plague-infected bodies were thrown over the walls of the city as sort of a war tactic. And then the final human factor I want to discuss is the unintentional spread of disease. So bioterrorism is the intentional spread, whereas this would be the unintentional spread of disease. And there's a really interesting case of this that I want to talk about, and that's the case of Typhoid Mary, or Mary Mallon. And she was a cook in New York in the early 20th century. But she was also an asymptomatic carrier of the bacterium Salmonella typhi, which causes typhoid fever. Now, what I mean by asymptomatic is that she carried the disease in her body. It was actually in her gallbladder. She was able to shed it from her body. It's spread by the fecal oral route, but she never actually got sick from it. And so it was discovered that from 1900 to 1907, she cooked for about 8 different families, and 7 of them had typhoid fever outbreaks. So when they finally tracked the disease to her, she refused to get her gallbladder removed, and she refused to stop cooking, so they imprisoned her at detention hospital in 1907. They released her a few years later because she promised she would never cook again, and they gave her a job as a laundress. However, after being released, she quickly changed her name to Mary Brown, went under the radar, and continued cooking. For the next 5 years, she caused outbreaks of typhoid fever until they finally caught her again and put her in permanent quarantine for the rest of her life. And so the reason I say that this is unintentional spread is that she maintained throughout her life that she couldn't have been causing this disease because she herself was never sick. So what I hope I've illustrated to you so far is that the interaction of the pathogen and the host and the environment can lead to the emergence and spread of disease. And now what I'd like to do is discuss a specific disease that emerged almost exactly a decade ago, around this time. And as I go through the example, I hope you'll see how these factors are all contributing to its emergence and spread. And that disease is SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. And the reason I want to talk about SARS is because it was the first severe, easily transmissible new disease of the 21st century. But also, SARS, when it first came out, was a bit scary. We didn't know what it was, or where it came from, or how it spread. We had no vaccine to prevent it, and there was no treatment for it. So any of the treatments we threw at it did nothing. So since then, we've learned a lot more about SARS. And so what we know is that SARS is a novel coronavirus. So coronavirus just refers to the family of viruses. And strangely enough, coronaviruses are actually known for causing the common cold, but this was a new strain of coronavirus. And what a corona is it's the proteins on the outside of the virus. So if you see the little dots surrounding the virus, those are the coronas, or the spikes on the virus. Now, the signs and symptoms of someone with SARS is someone who has a high fever, maybe a dry cough or pneumonia. They're vomiting, potentially have diarrhea. Then they can progress to acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is when the lungs begin to shut down. And then this can lead to death. SARS, it was found, was transmitted by droplets, which means if I were to sneeze and I happened to accidentally sneeze on someone, they could get it. Or if I coughed on my hand and shook someone else's hand and they touched their face, they could get it that way. Or it was also transmitted by fomites. And what a fomite is an inanimate object that can harbor a pathogen. So if I cough on my hand and then I open a door, and then you come along and you open that same door and touch your face, that doorknob's acted as a fomite because it was able to pass the disease on. Money is probably a great fomite. I'm sure if you cultured money, it would have some bacteria, and if you took it and looked for genetic components of many viruses, you could find it too. And then it was also shown in SARS that most of the cases were due to intense exposure. So a large proportion of cases were in healthcare workers, as well as individuals who lived in the same household as someone who was infected. Now, the story of how SARS took off globally is a really interesting one, and it shows both the incredible power of how we can track the diseases, but also how we really contributed to spreading this around the world. So what I'm showing up here is along the top is a timeline from the beginning of December 2002 until May 2003. And then on the bottom, we have a map. So right now, it's just focused on China, which is the big white blob, and then India is just sort of the blob off to the left. What happened was in mid-November 2002, the first cases of SARS happened in Guangdong province. So there's Guangdong province, China, and the red dot on the map. And these first cases of SARS were primarily in food handlers. So this is anyone from people selling live animals in markets up to people in restaurants who were slaughtering and cooking the animals. And that's important, and I'll come back to that later. So these first cases happened mid-November 2002. But not until February 11th, 2003, was an outbreak reported to the World Health Organization. And the report was that there were 305 people in Guangdong province who were experiencing an atypical pneumonia. And what that basically means is they were having pneumonia, but it wasn't quite like a normal pneumonia. So from February 12th to 14th, what they tried to do is they tried to figure out what these people had. And what they discovered was they had no idea what it was. They could rule out influenza and Marburg and Ebola viruses. They could also rule out anthrax and plague, but they couldn't figure out what it was. In the meantime, while they were trying to figure this out, SARS moved out of Guangdong province and it moved to Hong Kong. And so you can see on the map there, the yellow dot is Hong Kong. And the way that SARS spread to Hong Kong is that a doctor who was treating patients in his home village in Guangdong province traveled there. And he stayed on the ninth floor of a hotel. And during his stay in this hotel, he was able or somehow managed to accidentally infect 12 to 16 other people on the floor. And as you know with hotels, they're very international places. So of course now we're going to have to expand the map to a global spread. And you can still see in China on the left-hand side, there's Guangdong province in red and the yellow dots Hong Kong. So as I mentioned, what happened next from February 26th to March 11th is SARS began to spread globally. So patients or other people who stayed in the hotel went back home or traveled around to Vietnam, to Singapore, to Thailand, and then, of course, to Toronto. And then the disease continued to spread globally over the next several months to countries including Mongolia, Taiwan, the Philippines, Australia. And then what was also interesting is the patient who'd gone back down to Singapore was being treated in a hospital by a doctor, and this doctor went to the States for a conference. Meanwhile, as this is slowly spreading around the world, on March 12th, 2003, the World Health Organization issued its first alert. And what they said was that there is increased cases of this atypical pneumonia. Very quickly afterwards, on March 15th, they issued another alert saying, whatever this was, it was a global health threat. At the same time, this doctor who had gone to the conference in the States told a colleague that he was having some similar symptoms to one of his patients in Singapore, but he was going back home. So while he was flying, this colleague phoned the authorities, and this man was apprehended in Germany and immediately put in a hospital because of these symptoms. So finally, on April, and it's actually credited with that work, is the reason why it didn't spread around Germany so much. It was contained very quickly. So finally, on March 27th, the agent was discovered, and it was discovered, as I mentioned before, that this was a coronavirus. And then on April 4th, the World Health Organization was able to get into Guangdong province and prove that this virus that had been spreading around the world was the same one there, and that this was the primary location where the disease started. And then throughout April and May, as cases began to continue spreading throughout the World Health Organization issued its most severe alert it's ever issued in its 55-year history, which was to eliminate all non-essential travel to areas where there was infection. So all told, SARS, from November 1st, 2002 until August 7th, 2003, there was 8,422 cases of SARS reported, with just over 900 deaths globally. There was about 30 countries that reported cases of SARS, with the countries with the most cases being China, which included Hong Kong, Taiwan, Canada, Singapore, and Vietnam. And it's estimated that the global economic impact of SARS in this short time cost the world anywhere from $30 to $100 billion. So how did these factors that we've discussed before, the pathogen, the human, and the environment, contribute to the emergence and the spread of SARS? Well, first we'll start with the environment. And as I said before, the first cases seem to be in food handlers. So anyone from the person working in the market with the live animals and selling them to the people slaughtering and cooking the animals in restaurants. So what researchers did is they went back to these markets and they tested a whole bunch of different animals to see if they could find a similar coronavirus to what was in humans. And what one research group found was that both civet cats, which are shown in the picture there, as well as raccoon dogs, had a SARS virus that was pretty similar to the one in humans. However, another research group found contradictory information. So they said they couldn't find it in any of the market civet cats, and they couldn't find it in any in the wild. And what this suggested is that the cats may have acted as an intermediate host and were not actually the natural reservoir for SARS. Now, what's also known is that bats can naturally carry other types of coronaviruses. So some researchers wondered if maybe it came from bats. And what they found by testing both bats in the market and in the wild was that they had a SARS coronavirus similar to the one in the cats and the humans. So the current working theory is that because the bats and the cats are can be in very close proximity in the market, the virus could have spread from the bat to the cat and then from there into human populations. So another factor that contributed is microbial evolution. And because it had to pass through so many different organisms each time, or so many different hosts rather, each time the virus had to evolve a little bit or change in order to be able to most effectively infect that host. And then of course we have the human factors. So one big human factor that caused the emergence of SARS is the fact that we created that environment. The bats and the cats would not normally be that close, except in these markets with overcrowding, it's very easy for them to exchange viruses. And then another human factor is the fact that because we traveled so much, this was primarily how SARS spread around the world. Now, I don't want to leave you with a doom and gloom message that we cause all these diseases and we can't do anything about it, because there was a lot of human factors in SARS that actually stopped the spread of the disease. So for example, because we have such an amazing global communication network, health information was shared really quickly and really efficiently between countries, which was able to stop SARS from spreading further. And in addition, when they discovered SARS, it was actually an international collaboration of scientists from 11 different countries who were all working towards a common goal of trying to figure out what this was. So this brings us to our final slide, which is a sort of a preview for the movie you're about to see, Contagion. And what's really interesting about Contagion is that they go through an outbreak and they go through it from different people's perspectives. So you get the perspectives of the public and the epidemiologists, people working to make a vaccine, the media and politicians. So we hope you enjoy the movie and we really hope you've enjoyed our talk today. Thank you for listening.
Evolution. Yeah, well, if you think about how quickly they replicate, they and selective pressure. Basically, if you kill the ones that aren't able to adapt, then so the ones that aren't able to adapt are killed, and the ones who can adapt survive, and they become the only ones around. So, as you say, it's not really that there's their willpower; it's just they're forced. We force them into that kind of being resistant or whatever. So,
yes.
You hear talk about phages to fight bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are phages?
Phages are like viruses, but they're specific to bacterial cells. So most viruses live within human cells, but phages actually are specific to bacteria. And so they'll go to a bacteria and enter and lyse the bacteria. So they haven't been used medically yet, only in the lab.
Yes.
Well, can I ask you about C. difficile? What is that? And it's killing a lot of people in hospitals. And is it really contagious and all the time? Or people, I are home now, and they had C. difficile. Yeah. I'm scared to visit them.
Yeah. Should I take this again? So Clostridium difficile, whilst technically is very different to MRSA, if you think about it, it's a simple bacteria. So it causes gastroenteritis and gastro disease. But the reason it's now become kind of scary is because it has these resistance genes. So I showed about how bacteria become resistant to other drugs. Well, Clostridium is now becoming resistant to those drugs. So until we find a new drug that is very specific for Clostridium, there is a slight concern, but with general hygiene in the hospitals, we should be okay. So
it's spread by the fecal oral route. So washing your hands is a really great way to avoid getting it. Pardon me?
Is it contagious?
It is. It's absolutely contagious.
For the rest of his life.
No, you can. No. They treat it. No. It's not a chronic condition. It's an acute condition that can be treated. Absolutely, yeah. That's a good question. So they are infected with it, but they don't have symptoms.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I've never had the flu in my life.
Okay.
I was vaccinated against the H1N1, but I never had any other flu vaccines. So I'm just wondering if I'm capable of spreading it to other people.
Usually not. That's what I talked about with the herd immunity, because it can't actually replicate. So you only need a few copies of the virus to get into you to start an infection. But if you got vaccinated, it can't start an infection, so you can't pass it on. So, I mean, other than if, let's say, Richard had the flu and I shook his hand, then I shook someone else's hand, I guess technically I've passed it on that way, but I haven't let it replicate in my body and I can't sneeze it out.
Okay, so if I'm not vaccinated and I don't get sick, then I can't give somebody the flu that way?
Not through coughing it out, no, yes. Yes.
You've basically been talking about the biochemical aspects of the problem and the implication being it's only a matter of time before science finds the right answers. But that ignores the entire social aspect of the problem. The fact that we're living in a world where the disparity between rich and poor is getting wider. And if you think of the conditions that poor people live in, the overcrowding, the lack of sanitation, the greater interchange with animals, all these other factors would seem to suggest that they play as much, if not a bigger role in the question of the spread of disease than do the biochemical agents themselves.
I think they absolutely do play a huge role in the spread and the emergence of disease, as I demonstrated with SARS. I guess we didn't talk about that because it's not really something that, well, I guess we're scientists, so we like the science side of it, but it's not really something that we can directly control or predict.
Except that perhaps if the scientific community were more outspoken, perhaps the politicians might pay a little more attention to certain necessary steps in terms of public health.
It's an interesting point.
And then you lose your grant, that's the problem.
It is hard to get grants these days, but yeah.
Is there a correlation between increasing human population and increasing infectious diseases? Or are we sort of countering it with medicine?
I don't know if there's a direct correlation between number. I know the type of disease changes. So for example, when we lived as hunter-gatherers, it was often more parasitic diseases that acted more slowly that people were infected with. Whereas these days, because of we live in, you know, big cities and we're more crowded, these diseases that can infect you really quickly and then spread to someone else have... So for example, SARS wouldn't have happened in hunter-gatherer societies because you were isolated for such long periods of time, you would never be able to spread that virus, and the virus would just die off. So I don't know about the increasing number, but I certainly, the types of infections definitely change. Yeah.
Since these organisms mutate quite fast, and since our ability to develop weapons against them is such that it takes a long time, plus the fact that by the time we react with other measures, that also takes a long time. Don't you think that one of these days we're going to lose that war?
That's a question I can't answer. I'm just a PhD student. I would like to be positive and say that no, I don't think we will entirely lose the war. I mean, the thing with, for example, a virus is it can't live without us. So if we are completely gone, the virus is completely gone. And like you said, they don't have brains, so they don't know that. But I would like to think no. I'm sorry.
And even if we can't kill the bug itself, we are now educated enough to contain it, at least. So that helps to spread. So we may lose, you know, a certain percentage of people, but that's a slightly morbid way of putting it. But we can at least contain the spread to stop a kind of pandemic, as you...
So we were able to eradicate smallpox, and that was because of an intense vaccination campaign. But as he was saying that, I realized that SARS is a great example. We didn't have any way of treating or preventing that. So we had to resort to sort of more traditional ways of isolation and quarantining people who were sick and caring for them as best we could, but trying to contain the cases away from people who were healthy because we couldn't treat it.
If I may, by the way, just a few years ago, the world medical community believed that we had tuberculosis more or less eliminated. Mm-hmm. And yet in the last couple of years, because of poverty issues, it has come back.
Not just poverty, because of drug resistance, too.
A combination. So in other words, this is an ongoing war. You may win a particular battle, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're doing that well in terms of the war.
Absolutely. I don't think there's necessarily an end in sight to the challenges that we present each other. Yes, you had a question.
Do you think maybe like the way we're selecting mutants that resist certain antibiotics, that if a certain bacteria were to infect all humans, that maybe they could select resistant humans to carry out? Do you think that's feasible? Or?
I think long term,
the human race as a whole. There might be some resistant people that can survive the attack.
Yeah, rarely is a disease 100% have 100% mortality. So some people do survive, and then they're protected from it. I mean, we have sort of evolved with pathogens, and an excellent example is malaria. So if you look at malaria is mostly distributed in Africa, and if you overlay that with a map of people who have something known as sickle cell disease, which is a genetic disease, people who have sort of one, so there's it's a recessive disease, so that you need two copies of the gene in order to have the disease. But if you have only one copy of it, you're actually protected from malaria. And it's really interesting that you can see areas where there's malaria is areas where sickle cell disease is more prevalent. And so it sort of suggests that there's been this evolution of humans because the people who got malaria and survived obviously passed on their genes. And so that's how there's more people in those areas with the sickle cell.
It is true that the human immune system is generally the best defense we have. You know, it's been with us for thousands of years, and it's very effective. So as a kid, you play in the dirt, you'll get exposed to these bugs, and that will it trains your immune system. And it has been shown that people who are exposed to low levels of drug pathogens are more protected during their future life. So.
Doesn't mean that we're implying that you should all go
rub yourselves in the dirt.
So
I'm okay.
We should be worried.
I played in the dirt enough.
Yes.
What I'm going to say is going to sound absolutely terrible, but I've read somewhere that if we stop saving sick children and newborn babies, we will actually prevent creating a general human species that is weaker to viruses. How true is it scientifically?
I can't really comment on how true that is scientifically. I don't even want to get into an area of selecting who should live and who shouldn't. So yeah. Sorry, I'm going to have to. I've never actually heard that before, but
I haven't either.
Yeah. Yep. Yes. I have no idea. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. I have no idea how those would relate. I'm really sorry. Is that it? Oh, yeah.
Just yesterday, I think there was a note that processed food, or whatever the salt they use in there, is destroying people's endocrine system, mm-hmm. all the hormones and that. Is there any way to check that out?
I don't know, that's a physiology question, yeah, and one that I am not not able to answer. I'm really sorry.
Like all good Freaky Fridays, we're getting really good questions.
Yeah. And that's challenging us.
I think we need part two. Either you guys or your friends. thank you to our audience, and thank you guys. You've raised a lot
thank
of questions.
You.
Important topic. Erin first came to me with this idea. Glad she took it on. And to be continued, I will hunt down people to address the questions you guys have opened up tonight. Your thank you gifts. You each get
you.
A t-shirt. Erin, yours is the yellow one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The orange one, wear it with pride. And this book has some interesting stories about interesting things behind the Roddick Gates. Written by members of the Red Path Museum Club.
Okay,
they
cool.
publish every year their stories. That one was the first one last year, and there's another one coming out soon in 2013.
Cool.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you all very much.